Okay, and again, just to make it official, today's Bite of Torah is sponsored by Sam and Fern Rosenfeld in memory of Fern's mother, Chiana Bas Nasan, Helen Zurich, on the occasion of her yard site, Jake and Karen Abelevitz, in memory of Jake's parents, Eliyahu Ben Abba and Leah Bas Abraham. Okay, so folks, today's shiur, I would say, is as much for me as it is for you. And what I mean by that is that I haven't worked out entirely I know where the shiur is going, and I have the basic parts laid out, but I feel like there might be something missing, and maybe through teaching it and learning it together, a few more parts will be clarified as we go along. So let's start out with the following. If I had to ask you who are the heroes or the villains in the story, who would you say is the hero, and who are the heroes, and who are the villains by name? Anybody? It's partially a trick question, but I just want you to say what's the obvious.
Haman, right. And Mordechai and Esther.
Okay, so Haman is the villain, and Mordechai and Esther are the heroes. What I'd like
people.
I'm sorry?
And the Jewish people.
And the Jewish people. Why do you think the Jewish people are the heroes? Barbara? Did we lose her? Okay. So Barbara said and the Jewish people. I think that you can make a fair argument that Haman is the villain and Mordechai and Esther are the heroes. Not sure about Bnei Yisrael. They seem to me, at least at first glance, to be a mixed bag. You know, they are, maybe they're heroes in the sense that they ultimately come around and they seem to rally around the cause. But I don't think, you know, the Jewish people as a whole are represented as the protagonists in this story and as the heroes. But okay, Barbara, you're back.
Yes, I'm sorry. I had a call, and by mistake, I want it.
Okay, so why do you say that? Why do you say that the Jewish people are the heroes?
I can't talk now. I'll call you back. because of the Jewish people, you know, kimu v'kiblu, that they accepted the Torah upon themselves.
Okay, so
that's like a big part in the miracle as well.
Okay, so the Jewish people can be termed as heroes or heroines, and because of the fact that they ultimately come around to to doing the right thing. And I guess there is heroism in changing. And so if the Jewish people start out certainly in through the interpretation of Chazal, through the in the read of the Psukim, as whooping it up in the palace of the king, and being part and parcel of acculturation to the point of assimilation in the palace of the king, then, you know, sort of coming around at the end to rallying around the cause, maybe that journey itself could be considered a heroic step. Okay, perhaps. I would like to suggest today that that perhaps seeing Mordechai and Esther as the heroes is not wrong, but looking at Haman simply as the villain is not necessarily right, or at least maybe it's incomplete. So the way I want to start our journey here, or this investigation, is by looking at a few dates in the Megillah. So last night I read over the Megillah to just make sure I wasn't missing anything. But in case I'm missing something, you'll tell me now. Can anybody tell me any particular dates that are mentioned in the Megillah? There are a few. Anybody know offhand? All right. So a few. I'm sorry.
Kav Gimel Nisan.
Sivan. Yeah. So. So one the. Leave it to Barbara to know the least well-known of the of the dates. Yeah. So the least well known of the dates is the 23rd of Sivan. So we have a Sivan date. All right. Anything else? Anybody know of anything else?
Well, Pesach.
Okay. So
But
we have.
Tetvav Nisan or Tet Zayin, one of the others.
So we have Nisan dates. I'm going to read the pasuk in a moment. So we have a Sivan reference, meaning the second month of the year. Nisan being the first month of the year, Sivan being the second month. So we have a Sivan reference. We have a Nisan reference, and then we have one more important date mentioned here in the in.
Yud
Okay, we have Adar. Okay, so we have the 13th of Adar, which is an Adar reference. We have Nisan. We have a Nisan reference, and we have a Sivan reference. I want to look at least at the Nisan and the Nisan and the Adar references, and maybe we'll mention the Sivan one towards the end. So let's start with Perek Gimel. If you have a Megillah or a Chumash in front of you, does anybody not have a Megillah in front of them? If you don't, maybe I okay. So
Yeah.
It may be in here someplace. One second.
Are you
I
using an
got
art scroll Chumash? All right.
There in the Herz. Is it in there somewhere?
It could be. All right. So the first data I want to look at is in Perek Gimel. Achar Advarim Ha'ela, after these events. So Achashverosh gave a promotion to Haman, and he made him, number two in the kingdom. And a few psukim later, it says that Haman was upset. Ki ein Mordechai korea umishtachavelo. Mordechai did not bow down to him, and he was upset, and he was angry, and he was resentful. And Haman decides he's going to not only take vengeance upon Mordechai, but upon everything that Mordechai represents, i.e., the Jewish people. I always like to point out, and I think I've mentioned this in the past, when I was a kid. In, I don't know, maybe 7th or 6th grade, I remember going on a school trip, and the principal of of my elementary school at the time was Rabbi Philip Russ. I know some of you might know him, and he was the principal. And I remember vividly before we went on the school trip, he said, "You all have to behave nicely, because if you're on the bus and you're yelling out the windows, nobody's going to say, 'Look at those silly children, behaving inappropriately.' They're going to say, 'Those Jewish people are terrible.' So you, 7th graders or 6th graders, are representing the entire Jewish people on your school trip." And while that is might be a weighty thing to say to a to an 11 or 12-year-old, but it's true. Haman doesn't just say, "I'm going to get back at Mordechai." Mordechai now becomes a representative of the entire Jewish people, and now the entire Jewish people have to pay and are brushed with the same are painted with the same brush stroke as Mordechai. So that's it. Mordechai, he was upset with Mordechai. All the Jewish people are meant to pay. And now we get to the first date, Pasuk 7. B'chodesh harishon u'chodesh Nisan, b'shnas 12 l'malchus Achashverosh. It was in the first month, i.e., Nisan. He peel poor hu hagoral. So it's in the month of Nisan that Haman does his lottery to establish the day in which he's going to decimate, wipe out, and kill the Jewish people. That's in the month of Nisan. He peel poor hu hagoral. Miyom miyom u'michodesh l'chodesh 12 u'chodesh Adar. And the day which he picks, right, is going to be right. Miyom liyom, michodesh lechodesh, shnei masar hu chodesh Adar. So 12 months later, it's going to be the month of Adar. Okay, so the lottery is done in Nisan, and the day of destruction is meant in the month of Adar. Vayomer Haman lemelech Achashverosh, and Haman says to Achashverosh, "There's a nation we don't like them. We're going to get rid of them." And he says, "Fine, do with them what you will." Pasuk 12, Vayikaru Sofrei HaMelech Vachodesh HaRishon, and the scribes of the king call out in the Bechodesh HaRishon, B'shlosha Asar Yom Bo, on the 13th day of the month of Nisan. So that's Erev Pesach, right? It's the day before, before Bedikas Chametz. B'shlosha Asar Yom Bo, and they write down Haman's plan and his decree about what's going to happen, and they send it out to the kingdom. Vinishlach Sfarim, and it says that all the Jewish people, lahashmid laharog la'abed, everybody is going to be decimated. Bishlosha sar lechodesh shnei sar lechodesh adar, on the 13th day of the 12th month of Adar. Okay. So we have here, interestingly enough, the lottery takes place in Nisan. The date of destruction is in Adar. And the Megillah goes in great length to tell us this. In other words, there is a significance of the fact. This is not just a historical account. There's a significance of the fact that it happened in the 12th month, or that the lottery happened in the first month, and the and whatchamacallit, and the day of destruction is set for the 12th month. Now these dates come up again sort of later on, but what becomes clear is that these dates are significant. And so question number one that I want to raise is why is it significant? This story would read, you know, whenever you're reading a story in Tanakh, you have to ask yourself, if I would delete this word, if I would delete this pasuk, if I would delete this, would the story continue on uninterrupted? And I would argue, without telling us that it was on the first month or the 13th or the month of Nisan or the month of Adar, so the story would move on. All we need to know is at the very end, if we want to declare a holiday, so it should say, you know, declare the holiday on this day when the miracle occurred and the Jewish people were saved. That's all you need to know. But the dates here, nevertheless, are said, repeated multiple times here in the middle and in the end. So, just for example, if you go to the end of the Megillah, and here it becomes a little bit more meaningful. But because it's telling us when it happened, so we can know when to celebrate. But it happens again, and the Torah tells us again, but multiple times. So if you look in Perek 9, and go to Pasuk 17, Yom Shlosha Asar Lechodesh Adar. Now it happens on the 13th day of the month of Adar. There was a battle. Vinoach ba'arba sarbo, and on the 14th day they rested, and they had a great celebration. And in Shushan on the 13th and the 14th they fought, and on the 15th day, right? But again, so that's fine. That's I think reasonable. We have to know when it happens, and we know when to celebrate. But it goes on. Al kena Yehudim ha'pruzim ayoshvim as yom osim as yom harba sar lechodesh Adar. They made the 14th day of Chodesh Adar. And it says it yet again. Pasuk 21. L'kayem aleim li'oso simes yom arba asar l'chodesh Adar. V'es yom chamisha asar bo. So there's this multiple references to the month of Adar, as well as earlier on to the month of Nisan. And I ask the question, why is this significant? Okay, so let's hold that question in abeyance. So one thing I raised was who is the villain and who is the hero. Second question, and that was sort of a informational question, but I want to come back to that at the end. The second question I raised is the significance of the dates, and I hope that what I've demonstrated thus over the last couple of minutes is that the amount of times that the Torah mentions the month of Nisan and the month of Adar is really, number one, not significant. These time frames are not significant. It's not a history book. And to the extent that it's repeated, makes it even more significant. So it didn't have to mention it really at all at the beginning. And the amount of times it mentions it makes it a significant. So the question is, what is the significance of these of mentioning these dates?
Okay. Rabbi?
Yes.
We left out an important antagonist, and that was Achashverosh.
Okay, so I'll put Achashverosh and Haman as in the group of the villains, and Mordechai and Esther in the group of the heroes. And I will come back to that. Okay, so question number three here, point number three to these dates is, it happens not to be the case this year. We don't have a leap year, but in the case of a leap year, there are two Adars. Adar Aleph, Adar Rishon, and Adar Sheni, Adar Aleph and Adar Beis. In which of the 2 months is Purim celebrated? The answer is in Adar Beis. Why is Purim celebrated in Adar Beis? And the answer that the Talmud says is the reason is in order to be Somech Geula LeGeula. So that way the redemption of Adar, i.e. Purim, should be seamlessly connected to the redemption of Pesach. In other words, that Chazal are saying, what does that mean? So they just want to have like a literary parallelism here? What does that mean? I want to have the redemption of Pesach next to the redemption of Purim next to the redemption of Pesach. Why? To what end is that necessary? I mean, is there something, you know, beyond just some type of literary parallelism or just to make it look nice on the calendar? Obviously, I'm going to take the position that there is something more. But by the rabbis connecting Adar and Nisan, Purim and Pesach, they are indeed, I believe, underscoring that there is, that the two are connected at the hip, that there is a profound and deep connection between the month of Nisan, when in our story the plot was hatched, and the month of Adar, when the plot was meant to be executed. And it's not just a historical thing, but there is a there's something more deep seated, right? So again, this third question is why, when we have a double Adar, is Adar celebrated in the second month? Purpose: in order to connect Purim to Pesach, the redemption of Adar to be connected to the redemption of Nisan. Those 2 months come right next to one another. And the question there is, what is the significance? So, if I have lost you now by raising what seems to be, what may seem to be three really unrelated questions, I would like to assure you that they're not unrelated. And now perhaps to look at to some additional information to see how all these three questions really are reflect an underlying theme of Purim and an underlying theme of the Megillah. Okay. So again, why is the Adar and Nisan mentioned? What's the significance? Number two, what is the who are the villains and who are the villains and the heroes? Number two, with the connection of Adar and Nisan, and number three, why are these dates mentioned all together? What is the significance of their being mentioned to the extent that they are mentioned in the Megillah? Okay, so let's go back to thinking about our heroes and our villains. Let's start there. Now, Chazal often give us a backstory. You know, if you look at Hollywood in the last, 20 or so years, last two decades, many movies have been written to give you a backstory to an original story. I guess there's money to be made in that. Right. So what's there is a backstory here that can help inform our understanding of the story of the Megillah. And specifically, the relationship between Mordechai and Haman. Right? So let's look at the Pasuk. Let's go back to chapter 3, where I started reading earlier. Achar HaDvarim HaEleh, after these events, Haman was promoted. and he becomes number two to the king. V'chol avdei hamelech, chapter 3, pasuk 2. V'chol avdei hamelech asher b'shar hamelech, kor mishtachavim l'ma, and everyone is bowing and prostrating themselves before Haman, ki chen tzivalo hamelech, on the decree of the king. Where Mordechai lo yichrav lo yishtachavim. Mordechai is not bowing. V'yom avdei hamelech, and the courtiers in the palace are asking one another, Madua tao veres mitzvah samelech. Why? They're asking Mordechai, why aren't you bowing down? Why are you violating the edict of the king? Vayikam rame lav yom vayom, velo shoma alehem. Vayagidu lahaman liros hayamdu divrei Mordechai, ki yigid lahem asher hu Yehudi. So this was coming up over and over and again, and he just ignored them. And they shared this with Haman. And Vayar Haman ki ein Mordechai kor mishtachavelo. And Haman sees that Mordechai is not bowing. Vayimalei Haman chema, and Haman wells up with anger. Vayivas beinav lishloach yad b'Mordechai levado ki gidulo esam Mordechai veikiv akesh Haman lashmidas kol hayudim. And he is so angry, and he's so upset, and he's so resentful, that he wants to take it out entirely on Mordechai and on Mordechai's nation. So let me ask you the question. Does this make sense? I'm not saying it doesn't make sense. How do you explain Haman's behavior? I mean, is he a madman? Is he a madman? One guy does it about him and he gets all upset? I mean, how do you understand? I mean, it seems almost that he's insane. He's insane. One guy isn't bowing down. This is the whole kingdom is going to be overturned because of this one guy. How do you understand Haman's response and Haman's reaction? I'm curious if you've thought about it, and if you have, or if you haven't, if you have any gut reactions, how to explain Haman's behavior here.
It's interesting because this is what I learned from a different shiur, that Haman didn't even notice this originally, that Mordechai wasn't bowing down. It was because of the servants.
Okay, but I'm trying. I would like to understand Haman's response here. Can anybody share with me how you understand Haman's, what seems to me to be an over the top response?
It's not meant to be.
He equated to the Nazis.
Hold on one second, Barbara. Go ahead, Ron.
I equated to the Nazis.
Okay.
They did the same thing. Okay, someone didn't stop, didn't do whatever it was, and they shot him on the spot.
Okay, all right. It seems Nazi-esque. Yeah, it definitely does seem like that. Judy, you had your hand raised. You wanted to say something?
I think it was stated before that he didn't bow because he was a Jew.
Right. Right.
So that would mean that all the Jews would be the same.
Okay. But all the other Jews were bowing. Right. All the other Jews were bowing. It was Mordechai who wasn't bowing. He was the Maybe only. He seemed to be an exception to the rule.
But it's still because he was a Jew. So he was. So that would be the whole. I mean, we're not negating that he was crazy too.
So one possibility is he's just a nut. Right, he's just crazy, and maybe like Ronnie said, you know, the Nazis were—I don't want to say crazy in the sense of not being responsible for one's actions, but you know, their ideology was crazy, and therefore they did create crazy things.
Because he was a Jew, it doesn't matter what the other Jews do, because he becomes a danger because he can influence them, and they become the.
Okay, so maybe he saw it strategically that this is a potential opening for lack of loyalty and an insurrection. So he wanted to stop it. My pushback on that, Judy, is that it doesn't say like Paro. You know, Paro, when Paro had a problem with the Jewish people, it says Havan ischak malo. Let's out with the Jewish people. If we don't nip this in the bud now, then they're going to continue with our enemies, and they're going to and they might come back to bite us later. But Haman, it doesn't say that. It says he gets angry and resentful and hatred. That's a different kind of response than Let me strategically figure out how to deal with this enemy. Pyro was no lover of the Jewish people either, but contrast his response when he saw a threat and Haman's response, if indeed, as you're arguing, he's responding to a potential threat. So I'm going back. So that's my pushback over there.
Maybe the threat isn't an insurrection, but a change in society. That these people want to change the structure of society.
And therefore, that's why he's angry and upset and resentful?
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Well, maybe it was just an excuse. This was the excuse he was waiting for, and Mordechai gave it to him.
Okay. All right. That would explain certainly this was the excuse that he was waiting for, what, against the Jewish people, Barbara?
Yeah.
Okay. So perhaps that's definitely a possibility. Chazal were bothered by this this over the top response. It can't just be that that he was nuts. I mean, it could be that he was nuts, but Chazal sees something deeper over here. And there is a tradition regarding Haman and Mordechai, and it's cited in the Yalkut Shimoni. And I'm going to share my screen with you now. The Yalkut Shimoni gives us a backstory to Haman and Mordechai.
Hold on.
I want to read it for everybody. One second here. Okay. So you should see your screen, and in the screen over here, I'm going to read Amar Rav Chisda right over here. Pamachas. If you want to understand the relationship between Mordechai and Haman, and maybe understand Haman's response, you have to know the backstory. Pamachas nasan hamelech mamon. It occurred once that the king, presumably Achashverosh, maybe a previous king, but presumably Achashverosh, gave money. V'shigram b'roshei gaisot l'chboshes hamidina. He took his top officers, his top military commanders, and he gave them resources and funding, and he said, go off to battle. I want you to go and conquer said territory. Turns out, Haman was a senior commander, and Mordechai was a senior commander. Natal Haman Mamon Shelo. Haman took his funds, the achlo, and consumed them. Velo nishtayer lo mamon. Apparently, he was a poor manager of the resources, and he and his troops ran out of funds pretty quickly. Kisheba lahotzi. Whoops, sorry there. Try that again. Kishibal lahotzi al balei milchama lohayo biado klum. So when he needed to now expend these funds on executing the war, so he didn't have the money to do the job. Aval, however, Mordechai chatzi shel mamon hayo biado. Mordechai still had plenty of resources because apparently he managed them better. Bahaman etzel Mordechai. So Haman finds out that Mordechai is doing okay. And I look at these as, you know, not sort of a unified army, but, you know, Haman had his army, Mordechai had his army, and Achashverosh funded them independently. Right? This is the overall goal, on conquest territory. But it's not like they're operating out of the same treasury. So Haman comes to Mordechai, and Haman says, listen, I'm out of funds. Liveni mamon, would you loan me some money? Zesha biyadcha, what you have. So I can, do what I need to do. So Amar lo, he says to him, Ein ani milavecha, I will not loan you any funds unless you agree to the following condition. Elen kein timkor nafshcha le'eved li. Unless you sell yourself as a slave to me. In other words, you will be subservient to me. You will be in my eternal debt. I have rights over you. Now, whether it means he was actually a slaveholder of Haman, or it means he has a profound debt which Haman, which Mordechai can collect on with unlimitedly in the future. Whatever it means, clearly Haman is now owed to Mordechai. Kibel nafshayhu, kibel nafsho v'hilveu. He accepted it upon himself, and Mordechai gave the loan. He made the loan. V'kasav lo, and he wrote, Hare Haman avdo shel Mordechai. He signed on the bottom line. This is the deal. Zav nafshe l'Mordechai betulma d'nahama, and indeed, he sold his soul to Mordechai for a piece of bread. Does this sound familiar?
Right. Rabbi.
Yes?
May I interject? So another thing that I learned this also, that he was his Eved, but I didn't get the background story. But they also say that they were Gilgulim, that Mordechai was a Gilgal of Yaakov, and Haman was a Gilgal of Esau.
Right. So but this is...
Sense,
this is
you just said it made sense.
Right. Okay, so here you have, it sounds very familiar, right? This is like when Yaakov sells the bechorah, buys the bechorah from Esav, right? He sells his soul for a piece of bread. So Amar Le Mordechai, Mordechai says, Hainu Damar Le Mordechai Lahaman, Avda Dekana Nichse, Avda Deman Nichse Deman. Okay, right. So at the end of the day here, there is this really interesting relationship between Haman and Mordechai. Now, let's go back to our Megillah, where the Megillah says, "Achara dvarim ha'ela," after the these events, beginning of Perek Gimel. Excuse me. After the events where there was this assassination attempt against Ahasuerus, and Mordechai, makes sure that the conspiracy is revealed. He saves Ahasuerus's life, and in Achara Dvarim Ha'ela, after these important events, Gidal Hamelech Ahasuerus is Haman ben Hamdasa. So Haman gets a promotion over here, right? Haman gets a promotion. So here you have one person, Mordechai, who saves Ahasuerus' life, right? And you have Haman, who is in the court of the king, but clearly somebody of importance, but not of the highest of importance. And the Megillah tells us, Achara Dvarim Ha'ela, after these events, Haman gets a promotion. He becomes the highest of the land. So let's think about this. The relationship between Haman and Mordechai, as understood by the Midrash, is that Haman is subservient to Mordechai. And now Haman becomes basically king of Egypt. He's number two in the land. But he knows he's a fraud. He knows he's Eved Mordechai. And so in his mind, he rises to number two in the land, but in his own mind, he's a garnished, he's a nothing. He's just Eved Mordechai. And he knows he's a fraud, and Mordechai knows he's a fraud. And so Haman can't deal with it. Every time Haman sees Mordechai, it's not simply that a guy is not bowing to him. He's number two in the land. He could just ignore ignore Mordechai. What bothers Haman, I believe, is that he knows the truth and Mordechai knows the truth. And as long as there's one person out there who knows that I am not really the Mishneh LaMelech, I am really not the number two, I am really perpetrating a fraud, psychologically speaking, I am threatened. I don't mean the position is threatened. He was a very powerful man, and his power was not threatened. But his identity is threatened. He cannot live with the fact that another person out there knows that he's just Eved Mordechai. I don't know if there's I was trying to think of a way to dramatize this, but it's, you know, I don't know. You're elevated to a position for which you feel that you are inadequate. And most people you're able to fool, but there's somebody who you can't fool. And because there's somebody who you can't fool, it gnaws at you. It gnaws you because you deep down really know that you're not really, that you're the fraud.
Sounds like a good
guy. Sounds like a good what?
What you're talking about Move. Is...
Go ahead, Steve.
Peter's principle means is you reach to a height where you're not...
To the height of your incompetence. You get promoted to the point of your incompetence, right? So, but I think that there's like a deeper thing going on here. So you know you're a fraud. The other guy knows you're a fraud. Mordechai knows you're a fraud. But you're trying to present to the world a different identity. Haman is presenting a false identity to the world, and he even is presenting a false identity to himself. And that's something that he cannot abide by. And that can drive you crazy. And that's why I think it makes sense when the Pasuk says, again, this is why Chazal are bothered by by Haman's response and provide this backstory. Haman's response of chema, of anger, and vayivez, and he denigrates and he's upset and he's resentful. I mean, those are not normal responses to this. But if you feel inadequate, and you know that the other person knows you're really inadequate, that's just too much to take. It can be mind-blowing and exploding, and it can create anger and fear and anxiety and all these wonderful, wonderful emotions. Okay, so that's Haman. If you had to summarize Haman in a word, Haman is a person who is doing his best to deny his identity. Now let's look at Mordechai and Esther. Mordechai lo yichrav lo yishtachaveh. Mordechai would not bow. Why? As Judy correctly pointed out, ki hu Yehudi, because he was a Jew. Lo yichrav lo yishtachaveh. He would not bow. He would not prostrate himself, because in fact he was Jewish. Mordechai never, ever denied who he was. And Esther also did not deny who she was. She hid who she was. But that was a strategy. That was a strategy of survival, and it was a strategy ultimately to be able to get her way into the court. She wasn't denying who she was. She was hiding who she was until the appropriate moment when she would reveal who she was. And that's very different. That's very different. Haman was denying to himself primarily, and he couldn't totally deny it. He couldn't totally hide his identity, because there was the very existence of Mordechai standing there looking at him every day. And every day that he passed him, it befuddled Haman's plan to deceive himself and to hide his identity. Mordechai and Esther are the exact opposites. Mordechai and Esther attempt their best. Mordechai and Esther are clear about who they are. Mordechai is clear about his being Jewish. Mordechai is clear about Esther. Esther is clear about who she is. And at the right time, she reveals it. Hiding is not the same as denying. So here we have two models. Two models about how to handle oneself when trying to engage the world and trying to engage others and trying to engage yourself in life. Haman's model is to deny your identity and to try to become something else. And that's the path to success. Mordechai and Esther's approach is be sure of your identity. And that ultimately is the path to success. It might be challenging along the way because you will be taken to account for who you are. But if you know who you are, then you have the strength of character and the to start with, and ultimately the help of Hashem to enable you to get to true success. So Haman and Mordechai, Haman and Mordechai and Esther are two polar opposites. Achashverosh is part of Haman's team. Achashverosh, I would argue, doesn't even know who he is. He's just like an idiot. You know, he has no identity. Whatever people tell him, he does. Right. So Achashverosh and Haman on the one hand are people that don't know identity, hide identity. And there is a medrash that Achashverosh started out as a stable boy. So, you know, there's a lot of hiding identity or denying identity that goes on with Achashverosh and Haman versus Mordechai and Esther. Okay. Where do the Jewish people in this story stand? And the answer is, they stand at a crossroads. They are a minority people in exile, having been thrown out of Eretz Yisrael. They are in the middle, towards the end, maybe even at the tip end of their exilic period after the destruction of the first Beis Hamikdash, before the binyan of the second Beis Hamikdash was complete. Sometime in that period, at that latter period, this is when the story occurs. Now, what is the way in which the Jewish people are meant to engage this exilic period when they are a minority amongst a majority? What they're supposed to do, the purpose of exile, is to reaffirm our identity as God-fearing, Torah-observant, Jewishly aware, and spiritually refined people informed by Torah Hashem. That's the purpose of the Galus. The purpose of the Galus is to reaffirm our true identity such that we are worthy then of redemption. But what did the Jewish people choose? So we start off our story. Vayhi b'mei Achashverosh was the beginning of the time of Achashverosh. B'shnashalosh l'malcho, and he has a great party. Yamim rabim shmonim uma asyom v'hashkos b'chle zahav v'chelim mikelim shonim. They have these grand parties with beautiful vessels and lots of wine. And Chazal tell us that these psukim are not just telling us that there was a party going on, but that the Jews were totally enmeshed. They had acculturated and assimilated into Persian society, where they are drinking, whooping it up in the palace of the king. So how did the Jewish people choose to use their exile period? By denying their identity. That's the way they were going to make it in Shushan. That's what they chose to do. And the arc of the story of the Jewish people during the story of Haman and Mordechai and Esther is about the Jewish people ultimately, through the leadership of Haman of Mordechai and Esther, embracing their identity. At the end, they fast to Shloshes Yamim. They are Yeshno Am Echad. They become actually one people, rallying behind Esther, understanding that they are different than the rest of the Persians. Unfortunately, because the Persian society cast them out, and they are now going to be persecuted and killed and decimated. So that awareness comes from without, but they then take it and embrace it within. They fast, they pray, they do what has to be done under the leadership of Esther. So you have two models here. You have the model of Haman and Achashverosh denying identity. You have the model of Mordechai and Esther embracing your identity. Each one of them come with a cost. Denying your identity comes with a cost of who you are and ultimately is self-destructive. Embracing your identity can come with a cost also. There might be a gzeira from the king that is going to come out against you. But you have the benefit of the strength of personality and character and identity that can somehow hope, that gives you the potential of pulling through. If you don't even know who you are, if you deny your identity, you have no chance of pulling through. So the Jewish people have a choice. And it seems that the Jewish people chose the Haman identity, the Haman choice, rather than Mordechai and Esther. And ultimately, by the time the story's over, they choose the model of Mordechai and Esther, of embracing identity. So in a sense, Haman is not the villain, or he's not just the villain against the hero of Mordechai and Esther. But Haman and Mordechai and Esther really represent two polar opposites, two different models, two different ways of engaging life and engaging yourself. And ultimately, as this is a book of a Jewish book, a book of Judaism and spirituality and fidelity to Hashem and Torah, this is also a story about how we identify ourselves as Jews in the context of living in the world around us. Do we shed our identity and deny our identity in order to move up the social ladder? Or do we embrace our identity? Great story that you might have read recently, and I'm not making any political judgments, but great story. There's there was a financial seminar, an economic summit in the UAE last month or two. And hundreds of Israeli businessmen and so on, and you know, came. And there was one Israeli, actually an American Ole, who from Woodmere made Aliyah, became a Stalin or Chassid. But he's an Israeli, and he was the only member of the group that was visibly Jewish. The rest were Israeli, but they were apparently not religious, so none of them were wearing a kippah. And he was not only wearing a kippah, but as a chassid, he was visibly, you know, Jewish to the extent that that is a look which is associated with Jews. And apparently, this so impressed the sheikh of the Emirates you could read the stories in the papers and online, that this opened up a whole business relationship and a personal friendship. He respected the fact that this fellow was so outwardly embracing his identity. So sometimes embracing your identity can be of great cost, but sometimes, not sometimes, it is always valuable to embrace your identity, and in doing so, more often than not, one can hope that it will bring great treasure at the end, whether that is financial treasure or it is just treasure of living a vibrant, true life. But denying one's identity can only lead to self-destruction, and that's ultimately where Haman leads. So let's go back now with this understanding of the backstory of Haman and Mordechai, the notion of denying identity versus embracing identity. And let's go back to our original question. So the first question was, you know, who's the hero and who's the villain? And I think we just answered that. It's not really so much about who's a hero and who's a villain, but the Megillah presenting to us two models for how we go about engaging life, and how the Jewish people have to go about engaging, and what Klal Yisrael did in the arc of the story. But this gets to the second question, which is, why are the months of Nisan and Adar mentioned particularly so in the story to draw our attention? And I think it becomes very clear now, because what is the story of Nisan, the story of Pesach? The story of Pesach is about assuming our identity. What do we have to do? We have to take blood and of the Paschal Lamb, of the Carbon Pesach, and put it on the mezuzah. What was that? What was the purpose of that? So Hashem should know who's in the house? Hashem knows who's in the house. The purpose of putting the dam on the mezuzah was in order for the Jewish people to throw in their lot, to cast their identity with Moshe Rabbeinu and what Klal Yisrael is going to become. Pesach, Yetzias Mitzrayim, Nisan, is nothing less than declaring without reservation our fidelity to who we are, our identity. That's what Pesach is. And when does this story begin? When do these lots begin? The lots begin in Nisan. In Nisan. That's when it happens. That's when it happens. And that's when Esther fasts. That's when the Jewish people fast.
And, on Pesach.
And on Pesach. What does that mean, they fast? That means that they are embracing their identity. So Pesach, Nisan, is about embracing our identity. Haman, who's all about denying the identity, tries to, deigns to conspire against the future of the Jewish people. But the Jewish people embrace the Nisan. And he's up against Nisan. Denying identity can never win against embracing identity. Maybe in the short run, but in the long run, it cannot win. So Nisan is an important month. And then Adar is an important month, because Adar is the time when the Jewish people indeed embrace their identity against the conspiracy of Haman. So Adar and Nisan are connected at the hip. They are connected. They're all about the Jewish people embracing their identity of what it means to be a Jew. So Nisan, the reason that it says Nisan and Adar is built on our first point, that it's the Haman-Mordechai dichotomy here, embracing identity versus denying your identity. And Nisan and Adar are about embracing identity in the face of Haman, who really would like people just to deny their identities. Then we ask the third question. And the third question is, when Adar falls out, and we have a double Adar, Purim falls out in the second Adar, to be somech geula legeula. So the redemption of Adar is next to the redemption of Nisan. What does that mean? So let's think again. The redemption of Nisan is the Jewish people embracing their identity, and then Yad Hashem, the hand of Hashem, comes forward. Purim is about the Jewish people embracing their identity, and then the Yad of Hashem, the hand of Hashem, enabling things to move forward. There's also, Esther does a remarkable thing as well by actually deigning to go into the court of the king. But sort of broadly speaking, when it comes to the matters of the spirit, spiritual matters, that's in our hands. That's what we get to do. That's what we are charged with doing. Right, so if Pesach is about the Jewish people embracing their identity, and then Hashem stepping in to make things happen the way He does on Pesach, Purim is about the Jewish people ultimately embracing their identity, and then being the beneficiaries of Hashem's orchestrating all these events to our benefit. So at the end of the day, what emerges is that the ethos of the Megillah is really about Klal Yisrael generally and each one of us individually standing up and embracing our identity as divine beings, as loyal servants of Hashem, having fidelity to Torah and to our tradition, not denying our identity in order to get ahead, but embracing our identity with all the challenges that may have, with the faith and trust that we will ultimately get ahead, as it were. That explains the crazy response of Haman against Mordechai, it explains this yin-yang relationship, as it were, between Haman and Ahasuerus on the one hand, Mordechai and Esther on the other. It explains why Nisan and Adar are mentioned to the point of, are mentioned in the Megillah that draw our attention to these 2 months. And it explains why Adar, when falls out a double Adar, we celebrate the Adar which is closest to Purim. Because at the end of the day, the message of Purim and the message of Pesach in this is about a Jew being proud to embrace their identity. I'll leave you with just one thought here. I think it's the Nitziv, and I mentioned it before. Marjorie, you'll remind me if I think it's the Nitziv, that the Nitziv says that when the Jewish people were in Mitzrayim, it says that the Mitzrim, began to persecute the Jewish people. And the Nitziv says, you know why the Mitzrim persecuted the Jewish people? And this is not to excuse the Mitzrim, but is or to blame the Jewish people for the acts of the Mitzrim, but it does belie a certain faulty thinking. It says that the Jewish people thought that they would shed their Jewish or Israelite traditions, and they would become pagans for all intents and purposes, and things would be better. And they would get ahead in Egypt. But the Nitziv says it's really just the opposite. When people see that you don't respect your own identity, they don't respect you. When people see that you embrace and respect yourself and respect your identity, then they might not like you, but they'll respect you. And they will respect what you stand for. And you might even have a chance of being... So I called the title of the shiur is called Mirror, Mirror. So Haman and Mordechai really mirrors for us. You know, they serve as a mirror. The other title that I gave the shiur, but it was too long, was we have met the enemy, and he and how does it end? Anybody know?
And it is us.
Yeah. So that's not the original. Anybody know the original? So that's a pogo. So we have met the enemy and it is us, but it is actually a riff on, I forgot, an American military leader says, we have met the enemy and they are ours. In other words, and we have conquered the enemy. So I think it's, and so then pogo said, we have met the enemy, and not that we've conquered the enemy, but we've met the enemy and it is us, or it is we, whatever it is. So I think really that's a perfect title for this year, because we look at, we have this impulse that, for many of us, we have this impulse that if we sort of deny who we are and we try to fit in, then we will succeed, we will have a better chance of success. If we give up on our ideals, we give up on our morals, we give up on our values, then, you know, I might succeed in XYZ endeavor or an XYZ relationship. So that's, we have met the enemy and it is us. Or we have met the enemy and they are ours. We have seen this impulse within ourselves, but we've overcome it, and we challenge ourselves to overcome it. So the end of the day, are we Mordechai or are we Haman? And the answer to that question really lies in the choices that we make every day. Okay, all right, Barbara, you had something.
Thank you, Rabbi.
You're welcome, Barbara. You had something you wanted to comment.
Yes.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Have a good day.
I just wanted to talk about the insecurity of Haman and Ahasuerus, because from what I learned recently, Ahasuerus was the illegitimate child of Darius, of Daryavesh.